Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm Brent James. I'm the Chief Quality Officer at Intermountain Healthcare. I'm one of the few who can claim this is my 20th National Forum on Quality Improvement in Healthcare. I had an interesting experience the other day. I was sitting in my office doing some work, and our CEO showed up on some business, and he looked around. He said, "Brent, you know, you've served us for many years." He says, "We'd be happy to give you some new office furniture." And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, "You know, Charles, this has served me well for over 20 years. I've got maximum cost effectiveness out of this, and I like it." And it was the third time he said that I really understood what he was saying. I'd become a little bit of an embarrassment to the company, I think. Well, last week, just before I came here, they came in and ripped out my whole office, and so I had to move out kind of into the hallway. And digging through the files, I found the first program to the National Forum and the meeting we had the year before. My notes, Don, said 287 people at that first meeting. The program was about this big, and it was about 4 pages thick. I look across you, how far we've come. How far we've come. I'll tell you this too, though. You may be like me. There are days when it just seems so hard. There are days when the hill just seems so steep, those fights that just go on to move it where it needs to be. It seems even more timely today. Our national economy feels like it's collapsing, frankly. We're tightening our belts hard. We're worried about budgets for the next year. Thanks, Don. Thanks, Maureen. I came back. Were you as inspired as I was as I listened to that vision yesterday? You see, I've realized something. I'm looking at the future of American healthcare. I've become more and more convinced that it's a bottom-up phenomenon. I hear about your successes. 1,700 lives saved in Michigan as just one marker along the way. And I realize that's healthcare reform, that we're working it out day by day in our hospitals and our clinics. People who come to work every day dedicated to the care of our patients. Now, I realize I'm talking to the choir a bit. That's what brought you here. And then I look at the expansion from a few of us in a small room, old friends mostly, and I look across you and I see the future, quite literally. Well, that's what this morning's all about, is that future. Before I go on, just a brief announcement, speaking of that. From 9:30 to 12:30, during the D&E sessions, you have the opportunity to attend personal improvement clinics. Improvement advisors such as Lloyd Provost, Sandy Murray, Bob Lloyd, Gina Crow, Jane Taylor, to name only a few, will be available for one-on-one coaching on your improvement projects. Sign-up sheets are out in the Delta Foyer. They'll be held in the Ryman Ballroom. So if you need hands-on help, you've come to the right place. That said, to come to the point, a few years ago I was asked by a federal group to serve on a committee. It was called the Citizens Healthcare Working Group. It was federal legislation sponsored by Ron Wyden from Oregon and Orrin Hatch from Utah, 13 of us. We were tasked to lay the framework for reform of healthcare in the United States. We initially held a series of evidentiary hearings, and one we held in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon. And at that meeting, I learned something critical. Our keynote speaker had assembled a team, and one of the members of that team shared the theme that had led to the change. He said, "Our job is first to measure the values of the American people. And then on the foundation of those values as policy experts to make it real." That's how he described it, and I think he was right. Well, we redirected just a bit and we set out to measure the values of the American people. Here's what we found. over 90% of Americans agree that health care should be, well, we called it a shared social benefit, borrowing from the Swedes. Don called it a right yesterday. Over 90% of Americans say that every American should have access to good health care routinely, regardless of their economic status, regardless of their circumstances, the color of their skin, where they live, or who they are. Over 90%. Second thing they said, to some limit. They said it's not all things to all people. All right? Third thing they said, the method for deciding what we share versus what you're on your own to receive, the things at the fringe, the things that are of questionable value, frankly, should be public and transparent. A uniquely American solution they were calling for. The fourth thing they said, though, was this. $2.4 trillion is enough. They said that $7,100 per person in the United States for health care delivery is enough. Almost 17% of the gross domestic product, $1.06 of our wealth for health care delivery is enough. We recently completed a study for the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. We used, well, the stuff you'd use, quality improvement tools, to estimate waste in care delivery. I think it's the most rigorous study of this type done to date. We estimated that over 50% of that $2.4 trillion is waste, non-value-adding from a customer's perspective. And we pointed out that the way that you eliminate that waste is by better care, not less care. It's by quality improvement, you see. You know, it's a funny thing. If we had that kind of money on the table, maybe we could handle a financial crisis. Maybe we could handle an energy challenge. Maybe we could handle a housing meltdown. Maybe health care is central to the argument, not secondary to the argument. Maybe we should be thinking in restructuring the United States of America and the world economy, we should think that it's not healthcare comes second because of budget problems. Maybe we should think healthcare comes first. Well, through the leadership of IHI, we've arranged perhaps the world's expert on that topic to address you this morning. Dr. John Kitzhaber is currently the president of the Estes Park Institute. He directs the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. He holds an endowed chair of healthcare policy with the Foundation for Medical Excellence. He's a former senator in the state of Oregon, a two-term governor of Oregon, where he ran the laboratory in the states. He built it, he made it work, and he taught us immensely. It wasn't just the Citizens Healthcare Working Group who learned at John's feet as we traveled to his city in that evidentiary hearing. It's the country as a whole in understanding what can be. Now, just one last comment. I think it's fair to say that John's a man of the people. I was talking to his staff. He was governor of Oregon. He said he got a call from another governor. It was Jesse Ventura from Minnesota. Just the body Ventura, that would be, the professional wrestler. And her staff, talking to John's staff, said, "Our governor can beat up your governor." His staff said in reply, they said, "Well, you know, our governor is a legitimate, real, does it every day ER doc." This was just after the Ara Schumann came out. He said, our governor can kill your governor. Well, John, all that I can say is knock him dead.
Not sure I heard exactly what he said off there, but I think it was, "I can anesthetize your governor," was the exact terms. First, it's a great honor to have been invited back here again. I think this organization is one of the great organizations in this country and indeed around the world in trying to change the way we approach healthcare. What I'd like to do this morning is give you a different way to look at the crisis in the U.S. healthcare system and hopefully offer you some very specific actions that you can take to help meet the challenge. I think the election of Barack Obama gave to many of us a new sense of promise and opportunity. Senator Obama gave us a sense of hope. But in order to realize that hope, in order to realize this promise and opportunity, will require truly transformational change in many of our institutions. And it will require the willingness on the part of all of us to re-examine and challenge our own assumptions and to see the world anew. This election was not a mandate to simply advance the partisan agendas of the past, but rather an opportunity to transcend them. In an interview with CNN a couple weeks before the election, Senator Obama said his top two priorities were fixing the economy and energy independence. And then he added, priority number three would be health care reform. I think the time is right. I agree with those priorities, but I also believe that our ability to fix the U.S. economy and to move towards energy independence is intricately linked with our ability to solve the crisis in the U.S. healthcare system. And let me elaborate on that. On January of 2011, just 2 years from now, the leading edge of the baby boom generation will become eligible for Medicare. There are 78 million people in that generation, 30% of the U.S. population, and when they become eligible for Medicare, when they fully reach the age of 65, the fiscal implications for our nation get into the trillions. Now, for a nation that's become acclimated to large numbers, like $700 billion, which we use to bail out Wall Street, or the $35 billion the auto industry is asking, $1 trillion may not raise many eyebrows. But it is a number so enormous that it's impossible to appreciate without some frame of reference. And let me offer you one. When you go back to your room tonight, get out your calculator and do this little exercise. I call it zeros matter. A million seconds ago was last week. A billion seconds ago, Richard Nixon was leaving the White House. A trillion seconds ago was 30,000 BC. Now, we've got a $10 trillion national debt, and it's escalating as the population ages. When the baby boom generation fully reaches the age of 65, the projected unfunded entitlement in the Medicare program exceeds $60 trillion. And we're planning to finance that by selling securities to Japan and China and other countries still willing to purchase them, giving enormous leverage to some of our major international competitors who are clearly unwilling and probably unable to continue to underwrite deficit spending of that magnitude. In short, issuing debt to cover the explosion in entitlement spendings would be a catastrophe. It is simply not an option. Today, Medicare accounts for about 9% of all federal income taxes. That number will grow to 19% by 2015, and almost a third of all federal income taxes will go to that one program by 2025. The point is, without changing our current fiscal trajectory in this nation, which is driven largely by the retiring or aging of the baby boom generation and the implications that has for the Medicare program, we're going to face a national debt of staggering proportions, and an ever-increasing portion of federal resources will be committed to this entitlement program alone. And not only does that pose a serious financial threat to the stability of our nation and our economy, the opportunity and costs involved will make it very difficult to make the investments in renewable energy R&D and the other transformational and transitional investments necessary to actually get to a post-fossil fuel economy. And that's why solving the healthcare crisis is so intricately linked with our ability to stabilize the U.S. economy and our ability to move to a post-fossil fuel economy. Unfortunately, the way the current national healthcare debate is being framed today is not, in my estimation, going to get us there because it is focused primarily on financing, on coverage. Now, there's no question that financing is an important issue. The cost of healthcare is rapidly exceeding the ability of many Americans to afford it. Indeed, last year, as you know, the average insurance premium for a family reached $10,880 a year for the first time, exceeding the gross annual income of a full-time minimum wage worker. Now, addressing that problem has become the central focus of most of the health care plans being floated today. Most proposals are seeking to ensure that all Americans have access to health insurance coverage, either by expanding their ability to access existing publicly financed programs like Medicare, or by making private health insurance more affordable through additional public subsidies. Now, I don't endorse those efforts. Don't get me wrong. This is important. Guaranteeing all Americans affordable health insurance is an important interim step. But we have to understand at the same time that this step by itself will not solve the pending crisis in the U.S. healthcare system and the implications that has for our larger economy and for our ability to cut ourselves free from foreign oil. Unless we can significantly reduce the cost of health insurance itself, these additional public subsidies, which are at the heart of most of these proposals, will simply add to the fiscal pressure that healthcare is already putting on public budgets, will add to the national debt, and will magnify the opportunity costs which are constraining our ability to invest as a society in other priorities. Coming to terms with this challenge, in my view, will be one of the defining issues of our time. And in order to fully appreciate the opportunity, the responsibility, and the threat that this challenge presents to us, it is useful to look at it through the lens of the generations that preceded us and the lens of the generations that will immediately follow us. So let me start with a question today. How many of you in this room are between 44 and 62 years old? Just take a moment and look around. Keep your hands up. All right. Everyone who raised their hand is a member of the baby boom generation. 78 million of us. 30% of the U.S. population. We were born between 1946 and 1964. Most of us were the children of people who weathered the Great Depression, who fought and won the Second World War, and who rebuilt the world in its aftermath. My parents, I think, were typical of what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation. My father was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1915. My mother was born in Joseph, Oregon in 1917. And they met in Pullman, Washington in 1939, where they were both graduate students at Washington State University. And they were married in November of 1940. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 found them in Iowa, where Dad had his first teaching job. And he was drafted in August of 1943. He was sent to basic training camp California. And on April 3rd, 1944, he boarded the USS Robert Sherman in New York Harbor for this perilous three-week trip across the Atlantic to Europe. And just before the ship sailed, a Red Cross volunteer came on board and told him his first child had been born, a daughter that he wasn't going to see for almost 18 months. My father entered Europe through Normandy, through France, marched all the way across Europe through the Battle of the Bulge to Berlin. And for the 17 months he served with Patton's army in Europe, my parents wrote to each other almost every day. And I've often thought it was a poignant tribute to their 65-year romance that they kept every one of those letters. And in 2002, my father edited them into a volume that he called The War Letters. They gave a copy to me and a copy to each of my two sisters. And this was a remarkable document. It covers the period between August of 1943 and November of 1944. It tells the story of two ordinary citizens, new parents, and the incredible sacrifices that they made to win the Second World War. And before my father died, I used to call him up on June 6th every year, which was the anniversary of D-Day, and I thanked him for saving the world. Because that is exactly what that generation did. But not only... Not only did they win the Second World War, they created our system of higher education. They created the interstate highway system and the transmission grid. They went to the moon. They cured polio. They eradicated smallpox. They gave us the civil rights movement, which led to its culmination with the election of an African American as president of the United States of America. They gave us the great social programs. They gave us the great social programs of the 20th century, the GI Bill and Social Security and Medicare and, of course, Medicaid. And as a result of that, our generation, everyone who raised their hand and most of their children have enjoyed more promise and more opportunity than any generation in the history of this nation. Now, I wanted to start with that perspective this morning because we should ask ourselves today what our legacy is going to be. What kind of world are we leaving our children? And right now, it's not a very pretty picture. Without a fundamental shift in paradigm, without a fundamental change in the way we approach our healthcare system, the way we approach our consumption of fossil fuel, without changing our priorities and our patterns and our whole way of life, we are not going to leave our kids a world of promise and opportunity, but rather a world of debt and degradation. Solving this crisis is the unfinished business of the baby boom generation. It is the defining issue of our time, and it is intricately linked to the future of the U.S. healthcare system. To solve this crisis, there are three elements that have to be addressed. The first is that we need a shared vision, a set of agreed-upon objectives that captures the desired purpose of the U.S. healthcare system. Second, we need an accurate diagnosis of the problem we're trying to address, why the current system isn't achieving those objectives. And third, we need a clear description of the design elements that are actually necessary to achieve the vision. Let's start with the question of objectives by pointing out or reminding ourselves that the purpose of the healthcare system is to produce health, not simply to finance and deliver healthcare. Healthcare has no intrinsic value outside its relationship to a health outcome. It's a means to an end, not an end in itself. No intrinsic value outside its relationship to a health outcome except as an economic commodity. And that point has got to be reflected in our vision, in our system objectives. Now, I believe that the work you have done here under the leadership of Dr. Berwick and others has created a set of system objectives around which a new system can be built. And this, of course, is the triple aim: to improve the health of a defined population, to reduce per capita cost, and to improve the patient experience in terms of clinical outcomes, patient safety, and patient satisfaction. You will notice that nowhere in the triple aim is the word healthcare even mentioned. It's a focus on health, which is where we really need to keep our eye. Now, shifting the focus of our national healthcare debate from healthcare to health is a daunting task, and it requires a fundamental change in our priorities, in our patterns of investment, and in the structure of our system, and a paradigm shift, too, for providers, for consumers, really, and for all of us. Now, to understand the magnitude of the challenge involved, let's take a look at this chart, which shows basically the determinants of health, those things that have the greatest impact on your lifetime health status. And I don't know whether this will show up in this giant audience here, but I'll use my super Oregon pointer. You'll notice that 40% are related to lifestyle and behavioral issues. 15% are a complex set of social and economic factors that also affects the 40%. 30% are genetics, but only 10% has anything to do with involvement in the U.S. healthcare system, which tells us that 90% of what keeps us healthy over our lifetimes has nothing to do with modern medical care. So we've created a system that's extraordinarily good at keeping people or taking care of people after they've been injured, after they've developed a serious illness, but we're not very good at keeping people out of the system in the first place. Now, as we'll discuss a bit later, one of the major reasons for this is that a growing portion of the cost in the system is generated by treating people with one or more chronic illnesses. Now, we know that chronic illnesses, many of them are preventable, and we know that those that can't be prevented can be effectively and efficiently managed, but it requires a certain type of delivery model. The problem is that the U.S. healthcare system, organizationally and financially, rewards isolated acute care interventions at the expense of prevention and wellness and the appropriate management of chronic care, which is why we are only getting a 10% return on investment in terms of health for a $2.3 trillion annual expenditure on health care. And that's something that's simply going to have to change. So my point is that very few people, I think, would disagree with these three objectives as the vision for our new system, as the triple aim to capture the system objectives. The problem is it is impossible to get from here to there in the current healthcare system, because both its financing component and its delivery component are structurally flawed, and tinkering around the edges of a flawed system is not going to get us where we need to be in this new century. Let's start with the flaws in the financing component, and to illustrate those, I'm going to start with a little personal story. Some of you have heard this before. A few years ago, I took a friend of mine down the Rogue River on a rafting trip. And this was an individual who'd grown up in inner city New York, had never been in that kind of an environment before. And it was August, and the fish were running, salmon were running. There were fish in the river, there were dead fish on the banks, and we floated by this magnificent male Chinook, maybe 40-pound creature, magnificent fish, but still heading upstream, but he was struggling against the current and against his fading strength, and he was all beat up. Those of you from the Northwest, I know there's some of you right out there, have seen these big fall spawners. They are just beat up. His fins were all shredded, and he had scars on his sides, and this white fungus growing all over his body, and that big hook jaw was opening and closing. He was just trying to drive himself up the river a little further. And my friend looks at the fish, and she looks over at me, and she says, "My God, what is wrong with that fish?" And without really thinking, I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with him. He's just dying." Now, we don't adopt the same benevolent view of the great circle of life as the Chinook salmon. In this country, we view death as alien, as an adverse outcome. We like to pretend it's optional. And through our medical system, we've developed this unlimited array of diagnostic and therapeutic interventions with which we fight disease and disability and try to stave off the inevitable consequences of aging. And that's led to this robust industry that's committed not just to developing these technologies but to financing them and delivering them for the benefit of individuals. So if you view modern medicine from the individual standpoint, it is miraculous. We produce miracles every day. It is amazing. But if you step back and view it from the societal standpoint, there's a darker side. Because this arrangement wouldn't create a problem if everyone could afford the cost of his or her own health care. So all the benefits of modern medicine would flow to the individual, and the individual would pay for the cost of those interventions with their own private resources. No public resources would be put at risk. But that's clearly not the case today. Today, as we just saw earlier, we are increasingly relying on shared public resources to underwrite or subsidize the cost of health care for individuals. So this is my first very, very important point this morning. What is really in contention in the health care debate and what we have to focus on is the allocation of shared public resources, not private resources. What people do with their own after-tax dollars is their own business. If you can afford the cost of your own health care, you're not the problem. You may think it costs too much, but you're not the system problem. And to illustrate that, let me give you an analogy. One of the consequences of my dual roles as a physician on the one hand and a doctor and a legislator and a governor on the other has been an acute awareness of the fact that how I am expected to allocate resources as a doctor is very different than how I was expected to do it as a legislator or as a governor. So as a doctor, I'm committed to the individual in front of me to do whatever I think is necessary regardless of cost, as long as some benefit defined by myself and the patient accrues. It's part of the culture. It's how we were trained. A governor, on the other hand, can't ignore cost. And my responsibility as a public official was different. I couldn't ignore cost. And my responsibility was to get the greatest health benefit possible for as many people as possible with the public dollars we could spend on health care as opposed to education or public safety or bailing out Wall Street. So in other words, in the public sector, we're dealing with resources held in common and they need to be allocated in a way that maximizes that benefit to the larger population from which those resources flow. And if you think about it, that's really what we try to do with the allocation of most of our public resources, but not with healthcare. The financing component of the U.S. healthcare system was not built around a broad and equitable commitment to access, but rather around something called categorical eligibility. Now, what does that mean? It means that in this country, in order to get publicly subsidized health care, as opposed to publicly subsidized education or public safety services, you have to fit into a category. And these categories were created in the middle of the last century through three acts of Congress. The first one was in 1954 when Congress granted, told employers basically that they could deduct from their taxable income the cost of their contribution to their employees' health care. That's not counted as taxable income for the employees either, so it's a publicly subsidized tax benefit for people with employer-sponsored coverage. And that's what created the incentives that led to the employer part of our financing system today. The other two acts were the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in the mid-1960s, totally unrelated to this. And we added then Medicare Part D later on in the SCHIP program. But these acts were enacted at different times, have no sense of common purpose. Medicare, for example, is a program for those in the category over the age of 65. As you know, it's an entitlement program coming due to everyone on their 65th birthday, regardless of their economic status, but it's financed by taxes paid by people who are still working. And as I indicated, it's the cost of this program when our generation reaches 65 that is threatening the fiscal stability of our nation and squeezing out our capacity to invest in renewable energy and anything else. Medicaid is a program designed for some poor people, but not all poor people. To be eligible for Medicaid, being poor isn't enough. You also have to fit into one of a number of federal categories. So if you're a poor man or a poor woman without kids who isn't pregnant, you're not eligible for Medicaid no matter how deeply impoverished you may be. Now, these three programs then form the financing and eligibility structure of the current U.S. healthcare system that has these two arms, the public arm, Medicare and Medicaid, which is rapidly becoming the largest one, and the private arm, employment-based coverage, which is gradually eroding. Now, because this system was built around categories and not a broad, explicit commitment to access, there's a growing gap between the public and private arms of the system, and in that gap are people who don't fit into a category. They're not 65, so they don't meet, so they're not eligible for the Medicare program. They don't meet the income or the categorical requirements for Medicaid. They don't work for someone who offers employment-based coverage, but they can't afford a policy in the individual market. And that's where the 50 million Americans are today, and they're joined by tens of millions of underinsured citizens who live literally one illness away from personal bankruptcy. And the inability to pay a medical bill is the second leading cause of personal bankruptcy in this wealthy nation of ours. Who's bailing them out? Now, because we built this system around categories rather than a broad commitment to access, the U.S. stands alone among the industrialized nations of the world in avoiding answering the most basic question in the debate, which is simply this. In America, who has the responsibility to finance the healthcare needs of people who can't do it themselves? A growing portion of our population. And because we've never answered that as a matter of explicit public policy, by default, we allow the economic market to answer the question for us. But markets, of course, are supposed to make a profit, not foster social responsibility, so it shouldn't become a real surprise to anyone that no one goes out and competes for people who won't pay them. Right? So in our market-oriented terminology, people with insurance coverage, we call them market share. You know, I'm 61, and so I watch the Hallmark Channel because it's got reruns of MASH on it, and the advertisers have caught my demographic, and that's where I learned about restless leg syndrome and all these other new problems that I have, and the drugs to treat them. So, it's people who have insurance coverage. That's the people we want to do business with. But people who can't pay, and that's a growing portion of our population, they are liabilities, and we try to avoid seeing them. And we've got a variety of ways to do it, but the most dramatic and insidious one, I think, is cost shifting. And you know how it works. When the people in the coverage gap get sick enough, or when they can't find a primary care physician in the community, which will be an increasing population for more and more people on Medicare, particularly in states with low reimbursement rates, they go to the emergency room. And there, federal laws like EMTALA require that they be seen and treated, and then the uncompensated costs are simply shifted back to these third-party payers through incremental increases in insurance premiums or bills. Now, those third-party payers then just shift the cost back onto individuals. The state does it by redefining the income eligibility standards for the Medicaid program to reduce the number of people who are covered. I call that redefining the poor for accounting purposes. Yesterday you were poor, today you aren't. We balance our budget, you get to go into the coverage gap. And you're going to see a lot more of that in the years to come. The other thing, the federal government does, or the state, private sector does it in essentially the same way. They either drop coverage altogether, and as you know, private sector employer-sponsored coverage is eroding at about 5+% a year because of cost. Or they increase co-payments and deductibles that put out-of-pocket expenses on individuals who at some point are no longer able to access the system, and they go back to the emergency room repeating the cycle. Now, I submit to you that this structure makes no sense. It makes no sense as a business model. It makes no sense as a social policy. It certainly makes no sense as a way to keep our population healthy. And it also costs us more as a society, both in economic and human terms, to leave a growing portion of our population without the ability to access needed care when they need it, than it would be to adopt an explicit policy of universal access on the front end. Because today, our policy says, in effect, we won't pay pennies to manage your blood pressure in the community, but we'll pay tens of thousands of dollars to take care of your stroke in the hospital. Or we won't make sure that all of our women have access to good prenatal care, but we're happy to pick up the cost of resuscitating a 500-gram infant in the neonatal intensive care unit and shift that cost to the shrinking employer community that's still willing to put it up. And that shouldn't be acceptable to any of us. We do have a policy of universal access in the United States. It's called the emergency room, and it makes absolutely no sense. So the single entry-level question that must be asked and answered in the financing component of the U.S. healthcare system is who has the responsibility to pay for the healthcare needs of that growing portion of Americans who cannot afford to do so themselves. And I believe that any way you cut it, this is a public sector responsibility. Just as it's a public sector responsibility to ensure that all of our children have access to primary and secondary education, just as it's a public sector responsibility to ensure fire protection and police protection and attend to the national defense, it is a public sector responsibility to ensure that all Americans have access to some effective level of health care. But, and this is very important, it can't be an open-ended responsibility because of the reality of fiscal limits. Public resources are finite. If they weren't finite, we wouldn't have a $10 trillion national debt. We wouldn't have a $500 billion budget deficit this fiscal year. And because public resources are limited, and because we can't spend all our tax dollars on health care at the expense of education and R&D and roads and public safety, it follows that the health care budget is also finite. And that means that the level of health care, the floor, the level of health care to which we are going to ensure all our citizens have access is by definition what we are willing to pay for with public dollars. Now, the concept of a floor is a very important one because one of the problems with the national debate about universal coverage is no one wants to talk about coverage for what. But clearly we can't afford to do everything that we can do for everyone who might possibly benefit from it. There are limits. And it is within this floor that we have to come to terms with our limits. It's within this floor that we have to decide what we can and what we cannot ensure everyone will have access to. It's here we have to come to terms with the realities of our fiscal limits. And what we're doing today is we're deciding by not deciding and simply ringing that tab up on our children's credit card, which is not only unsustainable, I think it's immoral as well. So the fundamental question in the financing side of the healthcare debate is not how to find more money to spend on healthcare. $2.3 trillion ought to be enough. The real question is to make sure that that growing portion of the healthcare budget that's financed with public dollars is spent in a way that benefits all of us, not just some of us, and that we actually get a health benefit for this huge expenditure of public resources. Unfortunately, that's not what's happening today. Most of the proposals around healthcare reform today at the state level and increasingly at the national level operate within the existing flawed financing and eligibility structure. They are not designed to produce a system that will actually improve the health of Americans. They are designed to give all Americans access to the system that we already have. Which brings us to the second flaw in the delivery system. The problem here is not how we pay for healthcare. The problem is what we're buying and how that care is organized and delivered and what return on investment we're actually getting for that huge investment. Now, Don Berwick told me not to mention him today. This is not the car he drives. But he does have an analogy, which I want to use, and you've probably heard it. It is one of the best analogies that captures the real problem we're facing here. So as Don likes to point out, every car has a maximum speed. And what we're going to do here is we're going to compare the performance of a car to the performance of the U.S. healthcare system. So you can take your Porsche or your GMC pickup or your Honda Accord or your Prius or whatever, your 56 Chevy, out to the Bonneville Salt Flats and put the pedal to the floor. Pretty soon it's going to go as fast as it can possibly go. It's going to reach its maximum speed. And when I heard Don share this story, he said, now, well, what can you do then if you don't like that? Well, you can yell at your car. You can file an incident report with somebody. You can offer it an incentive. But the point is, very good. It's just not going to go any faster. There's a reason a Porsche goes faster than a Volkswagen. Because the maximum speed is a function of the car. It's built into the car. It's part of the car itself. And by the same token, the poor performance and inefficiency of the U.S. healthcare system is a function of the system. It's built into it. It's designed into it. And that's not going to change just by changing who pays for it. And that is a huge shift in focus that has to take place if we want to solve the crisis in the U.S. healthcare system. Now, to understand that, we simply need to look, as we mentioned earlier, where most of the money in the healthcare system goes. And today, as most of you know, probably 80% of the money in the system goes to treat people with one or more chronic illnesses, from diabetes to congestive heart failure to mental health and chemical dependency issues. And secondly, the way those dollars are distributed throughout the population is very uneven. About 1% of the population consumes around 35% of the healthcare dollars in any given year. 10% of the population consumes about 70% of the healthcare dollars. So to recall the infamous 20th century bank robber Willie Sutton, who was asked why he robbed banks, infamously said, because that's where the money is. So it would behoove us, if we want to solve the healthcare crisis, is to begin looking at where the money is and how we might reduce that cost. Well, we know some things about chronic illnesses. First of all, we know that many of them are preventable. We know that the lifestyle contributes as much as 90% to the development of diabetes and 80% to the development of heart disease. We know that these diseases are progressive, that they start out with a very low level of intensity and then complications accrue. And if you don't get on those complications right away with the right interventions, they get worse, requiring more complicated, more expensive interventions, often hospitalization, sometimes poor outcomes. And we also know how to manage chronic care. We've known it for a long time. There are models all over the place, but it requires a certain specific kind of delivery model. You have to have physicians who actually talk to each other and communicate with each other and work in partnership with non-physicians, with the family, and with community services and providers as well, managing that person longitudinally over time. You need well-educated patients who can recognize the early signs of a complication. So if you have congestive heart failure and you weigh 2 pounds more this morning than you did yesterday morning, you need to know that's a problem, and you have to have a system where you can access somebody who can help you manage that on the front end rather than waiting till you're really sick and end up in the hospital. So we need a system that's integrated with shared responsibility, that's very collaborative, and does the right thing at the right time very, very quickly. The problem is that the U.S. healthcare system evolved one way and the demands on the system devolved in a different way. Just like the financing system, the demands have changed, the environment has changed, but the structure of the system hasn't. First of all, we still operate the model of an acute care infectious disease approach. In other words, episodic medical interventions of high intensity, treating a stroke or a heart attack or a broken bone. Now, that makes sense for a lot of things. It makes sense for the acute life-threatening conditions you might see in an emergency room, and it also makes sense for a lot of acute non-life-threatening conditions like a urinary tract infection or a strep throat, many of which are showing up in minute clinics, in CVS and Walmart. The problem is it's become a de facto one-size-fits-all delivery model in the face of very different delivery challenges, not the least of which is chronic care management. Secondly, most doctors still practice by themselves or in small groups. Less than 4% of physicians, I think, in the country practice in groups of more than 50. Doctors don't communicate well with each other. They practice as independent, autonomous economic entities with very little formalized collaboration and communication between one another. And that creates a real problem because the average person with one chronic illness may have 5 to 7 physicians taking care of them. And if they don't communicate with each other, the potential for drug interactions and gaps in care and other complications is enormous. And even if you have an electronic medical record in your office, it may well not be interoperable with those of other physicians or non-physicians who are taking care of the same patient. And finally, we don't have very good information. Most of the data on patients today is still locked up in paper medical records in hospitals and doctors' offices throughout the country. So the inability to have patient information computerized and aggregated where we can track it and monitor it prevents the healthcare system from having the kind of continuous process improvement loop that is characteristic of most other sectors in the United States today. You know, the most common admitting diagnosis for people on Medicare is congestive heart failure, and about 40% of those people are readmitted within 90 days with the same diagnosis. That's not a financing problem. That is a delivery system organizational problem. And finally, we have these financial incentives This is from a book by George Halverson, who's the CEO of Kaiser Healthcare Reform now, which is a really enjoyable read. But he points out that we've got 9,000 billing codes through which hospitals and doctors get paid, but there's no code for a cure. Hello? There's no code for prevention. There's no billing code for health improvement. They're not billable events. So it's not surprising that the whole system is organized around these revenue streams that reward isolated acute care interventions at the expense of wellness and prevention and the appropriate management of chronic disease. And just throwing more money into the system through the insurance side is not going to change any of that, which is really the heart of the problem. So my point is that there's no way that this system can achieve the triple aim, no matter how much money you throw at it and no matter who pays for it. We need nothing short of transformational change, which was one of the themes of the last presidential election. But you cannot achieve transformational change by operating within the constraints of this badly flawed eligibility and financing structure that we have today. So what I want to do in the next couple minutes is I want to lay out five key elements, design elements, that I think, in one form or another, have got to be part of a new system if we're serious about achieving the triple aim in the United States of America. First, we need a much more a rational and sustainable financing system. And I would abolish categorical eligibility and replace it with a publicly financed floor in which access to publicly subsidized health care is based on economic need, not an arbitrary set of categories that were created in the middle of the last century. Now, because of the reality of fiscal limits, there has to be a defined benefit in that floor. And I would define that benefit through a transparent public process where health services were prioritized from the most important to the least important in terms of the health produced, very similar to what we did with the Oregon health plan. Now, this floor could serve as the basic level of care for everyone, which administratively is much more efficient, very much like the Medicare program. Or it could serve for a floor for just individuals below a certain income level, with sliding scale subsidies that go down as income goes up. But it's a more rational system than using the emergency room to provide universal care for our citizens. Secondly, this new publicly financed tier, now we're talking about, again, the public dollars in the system, not about what people do with their private after-tax dollars. This tier has got to include what I call value-based cost sharing, where copayments are not simply used to shift costs, economic burden to individuals, but rather to help drive individual behavior and responsibility within the context of the overall system objectives. So you may have no copayments or very low copayments for services that are very effective in producing health or high on the priority list, and higher copayments for things that are less effective and things that may have a lower priority. So, for example, there may be no copayments whatsoever for well child care, immunizations, prenatal care, screening for breast cancer, prostate cancer, hypertension, diabetes, or the drugs you need to manage chronic conditions. Because any barrier to access to those services and medications creates huge downstream costs, both economically and in human terms. But if you have a service where there's less medical evidence to support the efficacy, let's say surgery for low back pain or prostatectomy for BPH, maybe there's a 50% copay. And if you want, and your partner want to determine the sex of your unborn child through an ultrasound, when the ultrasound isn't indicated for a healthy term pregnancy, you can get that too, but you have to pay the whole thing out of your own pocket. So value-based cost sharing recognizes two things we pretend don't exist in the United States. The first one is that people with more money in America always buy more stuff, including healthcare. And secondly, we are always going to have at least two tiers based on income, as every other nation on the planet does. But there should not be a qualitative difference between those two tiers in terms of health outcomes. Now, the third element is that we've got to design our care in a way that gets beyond the one-size-fits-all acute care model that underlies our current system. And I would recommend organizing care around what Dr. David Lawrence, the former CEO of Kaiser, calls families of conditions. That is, conditions with a common set of delivery activities and requirements, where a lot of the care can be standardized and the focus is on the areas of uncertainty. And I would organize initially around those five families of conditions that account for the vast majority of cost in the system, the vast majority of patient encounters. Pregnancy, childbirth, and early childhood care. Chronic life-threatening conditions, diabetes, CHF, where most of the cost is today. acute life-threatening conditions, the kinds of things you'd see in a level one trauma center, acute episodic non-life-threatening conditions, and finally, end-of-life care. Fourth, I think the revenue, again, we're talking about public revenue, needs to flow to regional and locally organized entities that assume risk and responsibility for the health of a shared, of a defined population. And that could, as the folks at I have pointed out, could be a hospital or an affiliated physician group, a large primary care group, a visionary health plan, or I think probably an entirely new entity. Now, this concept, which is really at the heart, I think, of one of the elements of the triple aim, is maybe the most radical, but I think the single most important component to create a system that can actually achieve the triple aim. First of all, it recognizes that there will be local and regional differences in how you deliver care. The care organization may be the same, the product may be the same, but you're going to provide care very differently in New Mexico, particularly if you have a large Native American population in your catchment group. It will be different in downtown New York than it is in suburban Seattle. So it recognizes those local and regional differences. Secondly, and most importantly, it provides a single point of contact, an advocate or case manager for everybody in that defined population, which allows us to then operate the integrator. It allows us to identify the 10% of the population driving 70% of the cost and manage them and educate them. It allows us to coordinate the medical and non-medical community and family services that are necessary to appropriately manage chronic conditions. It allows us to target at-risk kids and get them set up on a healthy life trajectory. And it allows us to create a relationship that gives us the capacity to provide the counseling and compassion and education and support, non-medical values that is so important at the end of life. Now, finally, payment, and again, we're talking about public revenue streams here, I think would take three forms. You would have a very generous subscription payment, the purpose of which is to manage that relationship with each individual. Patient education, maintaining the electronic record, office visits, etc. Secondly, there would be a risk-adjusted bundled payment for complicated conditions, particularly those requiring hospitalization. And then finally, an annual performance payment for improving the health of the population around certain metrics, reducing hospitalization, reducing complications, which to me makes much more sense than the case-by-case, procedure-by-procedure pay-per-performance process that's being developed today. And you like that, huh? Finally, and this is very important, traditional fee-for-service medicine will continue to flourish in this robust secondary insurance market for services and procedures that are not covered within this basic floor. Now, what I've described to you this morning obviously doesn't remotely resemble the healthcare system we have today. And moving from where we are to that system is an enormous political challenge because of the number of economic stakeholders involved. Now, we've just come off an election cycle, and after every election, the major culprits are listed as, in no particular order, as big pharma, the insurance companies, hospitals, and doctors, and then on down from there in levels of darkness. But the fact is, we're all part of the problem. The uninsured are stakeholders in this debate. So is everybody, the 60% of us that have good workplace-based coverage. You've got seniors on Medicare, people with disabilities and other special needs, employers, large and small, those offering coverage, those not offering coverages, doctors, hospitals, other providers, insurers, health plans, drug companies, medical device companies. The list goes on and on. And here's what happens. Whenever someone lays out a vision or a key design elements for a new system, every one of those stakeholders does a little bit of mental calculus. And they go, given the current organizational structure and financial incentives, if we go from where we are today to this new system, I'm going to lose some money. And so they all become advocates for or against a reform proposal based on how they think it's going to adversely affect them in the short term from an economic standpoint. And so because of this, collectively and individually, we have prevented a serious discussion of a problem that poses a clear and present threat to this nation. And we did it in this last election cycle. How many candidates did you hear even talk about the cliff we're coming to 2 years from now with the Medicare program? How many people talked about the organizational challenges inside the healthcare system? It was all about insurance coverage, and we can thank ourselves for doing that. The position we're in politically, I think, is captured in this little graph, this little picture. we're all on a raft. It's coming under this bridge here. We're going to call that raft the U.S. medical system. And in that raft are all the stakeholders. I'm there as a medical doctor. We got a hospital CEO. We got a senior citizen. We've got an insurance exec. We got a few business people. The list goes on and on. And we're floating down this raft, and suddenly we come around this corner here. And suddenly the river disappears. And we can hear this ominous rumbling and see the mist kind of rising from where the river used to be. What do? We turn around and we grab our paddles even tighter till our knuckles are white. And we start digging furiously in the water, trying to keep our end of the raft upstream, deriving some perverse sense of security that the people on the other end are going to go over before we do. We can do better. We can do better. And by the way, this precipice here is about 2 years away, my friends. We don't have a lot of time to figure out a strategy. Now, I have three more slides here, which I have blatantly lifted from Dr. Berwick. But I think this slide really captures the political challenge that we face. He plots economic burden on this side and time here. If this is the current healthcare system, the one we all know and love, and let's say this is the future state that's built around those five principles or something of that nature, and if we could move from here to here and the economic burden on all of these stakeholders went down during the transition process, it would be very easy. The politics would be easy. No one would lose. We would have done it a long time ago. But the problem is that it looks more like that. I mean, the reality is that to go from the current system with its structure, with its culture, with its financial incentives to a more rational system, in the short term, a whole lot of individuals and institutions are going to take a very, very serious economic hit. And all of those individuals and institutions have the capacity to jam things up in the political process. So it seems to me that to put together the politics of reform, we have to shift the focus of the debate from where we want to end up to how we're going to get there. Shift the focus of the debate to the transition. Now, what I've tried to offer you today in a very quick overview are the key elements of the vision of a new system, of what that future state might look like. Our challenge, then, is to drive the focus of the debate back into that transition by making the very real politics and economics of the transition legitimate. Legitimize and acknowledge them and change the focus of the political debate from how an individual economic stakeholder is disadvantaged in the short term to how we can mitigate the economic impact on all the stakeholders as we move from where we need to be to where we need to go. Now, what's going on with General Motors? They want a bailout. The only way I would support that is if that bailout was used to help them make the transition to produce cars that are fuel efficient and that compete on the global market and thus increase employment and stabilize that industry. There is no difference in the healthcare system. We will need some kind of investment, not to simply give more people access to the current system, but to manage that transition while the industry redesigns itself for the demands of the 21st century. And we have the capacity to do that, but without agreeing on a vision, there is no political pathway by which to get there. As the Roman senator Seneca once said, no wind is a right wind if you don't know what port you're sailing for. Unfortunately, I still think that the national political debate has misdiagnosed this problem as one of coverage. Our challenge, I think, and the challenge I'm asking or throwing to you today, is we need to refocus that debate by operating through organizations like the Healthcare Institute for Healthcare Improvement, by operating through the Estes Park Institute, by operating through grassroots movements like the Archimedes Movement. Our challenge is to use our individual and collective influence to rally around a clear vision for the future of the U.S. healthcare system and then call on our new administration and our new president to lead us through the transition. This is something that we can do. So I want to ask anyone in this audience or anyone who is listening online, if you believe as I do, that we need to refocus the U.S. healthcare debate from how we pay for healthcare to what we're buying, how that care is organized and delivered, and what return on investment we're getting for health, then I ask you to join me at this website. If you are willing to embrace the vision of a new healthcare system that I laid out for you today, If you are now willing to help move the debate from where we want to go to how we're actually going to get there, if you are willing to commit your time and energy and ingenuity to making sure this transition works for all of us and not just some of us, then come to this website so I can contact you, and together we can move in this direction. This is something we can do because we have done it before. And I want to remind you as I wrap up here that we have in fact been here before. In the middle of the Second World War, we retooled the entire U.S. industry towards the war effort. There was a period in which you could not buy a consumer car in the mid-1940s. And I would remind you of the bold challenge that John F. Kennedy offered the nation in 1962 when he said, "I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this century, a decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." Now, a lot of people don't realize that he had received a report, might have been from the National Science Council, shortly before he gave that speech that said, "This is impossible, Mr. President. We don't have the technology. We don't have the tools. We don't have the capacity. We can't go to the moon." And he issued that challenge anyway. It was a leap of imagination. And in fact, shortly before his death, and I believe it was in a speech opening NASA, here's what he said. "We shall send to the moon, 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston, a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, made from new metal alloys, none of which have yet been invented, capable of withstanding heat and stress several times more than have yet been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, controls, communication, and survival on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body." Talk about a leap of imagination. I submit to you that the challenge, the leap of imagination necessary to describe what the optimal healthcare system should look like is much, much less than the imagination it took to go to the moon. What John F. Kennedy gave us back in the early 60s was not a roadmap. He gave us a destination. He gave us a powerful vision. He gave us as a society a sense of common purpose, one that allowed us to refocus our energy, our creativity, our commitment as a nation to achieve a common goal, and that was going to the moon, and ultimately we did it. That is exactly where we are today. We need a common vision. We need a sense of common purpose around the U.S. healthcare system, and no one in our nation is better prepared and better positioned to articulate this vision for America than the president-elect. And no one is better qualified than Barack Obama to lead us through the transition that we face today. The challenges that we are going to have to overcome to get there, to reach our goal, are not as obvious or as urgent as the menace of the Third Reich, which motivated our parents and grandparents. But they're just as deadly sure. Maybe because they're less obvious. They're less obvious than a Pearl Harbor. They're less tangible than the specter of a Nazi panzer division, snuffing out the flame of freedom as it rolls across the face of Europe. But I promise you this. These challenges around the U.S. medical system, if we are successful in meeting them, will have every bit as much an impact on the lives of our children and grandchildren as did the winning of the Second World War on our generation. Albert Einstein once said that you should not solve today's problems by using the level of thinking you were at when you created them. I agree, but I think the late Western novelist Edward Abbey put it much more succinctly, although maybe not as eloquently, when he said, "Society is like a stew. If you don't stir it up from time to time, you get a lot of scum on the top." Our job, my friends, is to stir it up. Our job is to recognize that the responsibility to fix the U.S. medical system, with its ominous implications for the stability of our economy, for our ability to move to a post-fossil fuel world, doesn't belong to someone else. It's not going to happen for us in Washington, D.C. It's not going to happen for us in our state capitals. It's going to happen through the commitment and engagement in people like you and communities throughout this nation of ours. It's something we can do. It is something we must do. And if we're not willing to do it for ourselves, then we should do it for our children and our grandchildren. A gift for the future. Those people who are going to inherit our world and who, on our current trajectory, are going to inherit a staggering burden of debt and a dysfunctional system that was created on our watch and through our inability to act in concert as a community is being perpetuated. Let me close this morning with the words of Oregon poet Kim Stafford, who much more eloquently than I captures, I think, the challenge, the opportunity, but also the responsibility before us in what he calls Lloyd's story. This is a true story. Lloyd Reynolds, the international citizen of Portland, spent his last days silent, unable to write or to speak, lying in a hospital bed. On his last day at home, as his wife scurried to pack his suitcase for the hospital, Lloyd found his way outside to the garden. And there she found him on his knees, awkwardly planting flower bulbs with a spoon. Lloyd, she said, "You'll never see those flowers bloom." He smiled at her. "They're not for me," he said. "They're for you. Salmon coming home, they're for you. The calls of the wild geese, they're for you. The last old trees, they're for you and your children to the seventh generation and beyond. They're all blooming into being for you." That, my friends, is our challenge. To plant the seeds of tomorrow. To create that vision, that beacon of hope towards which we can lead our states and our nation over the next 5 or 10 years. By acting, by leading, by personally committing ourselves to this quest, not as captives of the past, not as victims of the status quo, but as the proud architects of a new and brighter future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kitzhaber. I just wanted to add one other quick statement, another thing that Albert Einstein said. He said, "It works better when you plug it in." So, are you plugged in? Is a question I'll ask you. I'll be certain that you're plugged in. I think refreshments in the foyer. The next sessions, the breakout sessions, start at 9:30, and have a wonderful last day of the 20th National Forum.